Robert Cialdini's Persuasion stands as one of the most influential books in modern psychology and marketing. Since its publication, it has become required reading in business schools worldwide and has been endorsed by everyone from Warren Buffett to Daniel Kahneman. The Wall Street Journal hailed it as revolutionary, while Fortune 500 companies have restructured entire marketing departments based on its principles. What makes this work so powerful is Cialdini's unique approach, combining rigorous academic research with undercover fieldwork among compliance professionals. After spending 3 years infiltrating sales operations, fundraising organizations, and recruitment agencies, Cialdini emerged with a profound understanding of how influence truly works in the real world, not just in laboratory settings. The result is a fascinating exploration of the hidden psychological triggers that shape our decisions before we even realize we're being influenced. Persuasion is fundamentally about what happens in the critical moment before a message is delivered. Cialdini argues that the most effective persuaders don't just focus on crafting compelling messages, they create receptive states of mind first. This principle operates like a psychological frame that determines how all subsequent information will be received, similar to how a primer coat prepares a surface for paint. Consider the remarkable case of an Arizona jewelry store owner who accidentally doubled prices on turquoise jewelry instead of reducing them by half as intended. Surprisingly, the items, previously unsellable, sold out completely at the inflated prices. This wasn't because the jewelry suddenly became more valuable, but because the higher price tag created a mental shortcut for customers. Expensive equals good. This principle has been replicated in wine tastings, where participants consistently rate identical wines more favorably when told they're more expensive, and in luxury goods markets, where exclusivity and high prices often drive rather than deter purchases. This phenomenon parallels what ethologists observe in animal behavior. Mother turkeys, for instance, respond almost exclusively to the cheep cheep sound of their chicks, ignoring other identifying features like appearance or smell. If a stuffed polecat, a natural predator, makes this sound, the mother will care for it, while she might attack her own silent chicks. Similar automatic responses exist throughout nature. Male butterflies will attempt to mate with brown leaves that match the coloring of female wings, and beetles will try to mate with discarded beer bottles that share the dimpling pattern of their species. Ellen Langer's famous experiment demonstrates this human automaticity perfectly. She found that simply using the word because in a request dramatically increased compliance, even when no actual reason followed. People waiting to use a copy machine were much more likely to allow someone to cut in line when they heard, "May I use the copy machine because I'm in a rush?" than the simpler, "May I use the copy machine?" The compliance rates were 94% with because versus just 60% without. Remarkably, even nonsensical reasons like "because I need to make copies" worked nearly as well, 93% compliance, showing how the trigger word "because" activated automatic compliance regardless of the quality of reasoning that followed. These mental shortcuts are generally efficient ways of navigating life's complexity, but they make us vulnerable to those who understand and weaponize our psychological triggers. Just as certain organisms in nature exploit automatic responses in other species, human exploiters recognize and manipulate our psychological triggers for their benefit. This exploitation appears in various contexts: salespeople creating artificial scarcity, advertisers using social proof, and politicians framing issues to trigger specific emotional responses. Understanding these persuasive triggers isn't just academic. It's crucial for recognizing when we're being influenced and making more conscious decisions. One of the most powerful weapons of influence is the rule of reciprocity, our deeply ingrained sense that we should repay others for what they provide us. This principle is so universal that no human society exists without it, and anthropologists consider it a defining characteristic of what makes us human. The reciprocity rule creates a sense of future obligation that proved critical to human social evolution. It allowed individuals to give resources to others with confidence they weren't being lost, enabling sophisticated systems of aid, gift-giving, defense, and trade. The power of this obligation transcends time and circumstance, as demonstrated when Ethiopia, despite suffering a devastating famine, sent $5,000 in relief aid to Mexico in 1985, simply because Mexico had helped Ethiopia 50 years earlier during the Italian invasion. The rule's strength is extraordinary, often producing compliance to requests that would otherwise be refused. In a classic experiment by Dennis Regan, subjects who received a small favor, a Coca-Cola, from Joe bought twice as many raffle tickets from him as those who received no favor. Remarkably, personal feelings toward Joe became irrelevant. They felt obligated to reciprocate regardless of whether they liked him. The Hare Krishna Society brilliantly exploited this principle by giving gifts, flowers, books, to passers-by before requesting donations. This benefactor-before-beggar strategy proved wildly successful, funding the society's significant expansion despite most recipients' initial reluctance to engage with them. Similarly, the Disabled American Veterans Organization nearly doubles its response rate from 18% to 35% by including unsolicited address labels with donation requests. What makes the reciprocity rule particularly exploitable is that it extends to uninvited favors. We don't need to request benefits to feel obligated to repay them. As anthropologist Marcel Mauss observed, human culture imposes an obligation to give, an obligation to receive, and an obligation to repay. The obligation to receive puts the power of indebtedness in others' hands, explaining why Krishna members would force flowers upon airport travelers who, despite immediately trying to return the unwanted gift, often felt compelled to donate anyway. Perhaps most perniciously, the reciprocity rule can produce drastically unequal exchanges. While it demands similar types of actions be reciprocated, favor for favor, not favor for attack, it allows tremendous flexibility in magnitude. In Regan's experiment, Joe's 10-cent Coke prompted subjects to buy an average of 50 cents worth of raffle tickets, a 500% return. We accept such unfair exchanges primarily because indebtedness creates profound psychological discomfort that demands relief. Our nearly obsessive desire to be consistent with what we've already done drives much of our behavior. Once we make a choice or take a stand, powerful personal and interpersonal pressures push us to behave consistently with that commitment, even when it's against our best interests. Research reveals our remarkable tendency to justify our commitments. A study of racetrack bettors showed they became significantly more confident in their horse's chances immediately after placing a bet, though nothing about the horse had changed. The consistency principle is so powerful it can compel us to act against our own interests, as demonstrated in a beach experiment where subjects who had merely agreed to watch someone's things risked personal harm to stop a stage theft. Consistency is highly valued in our culture because it's associated with personal and intellectual strength, while inconsistency suggests indecisiveness or even mental instability. Though consistency generally serves us well by providing a reasonable orientation to the world, when applied blindly, it can be disastrous. The power of consistency is activated through commitment, getting someone to take a stand or go on record. Modern telephone solicitors use this technique effectively by first asking, "How are you feeling?" When you respond positively, they leverage your public statement of well-being to request help for those less fortunate, making refusal feel inconsistent with your just proclaimed good fortune. Research confirmed this tactic nearly doubles compliance rates compared to standard solicitation approaches. The Chinese communists understood this principle perfectly during the Korean War, arranging POW camp experiences so American captives would consistently act in ways that gradually shifted their self-image. Their method? Start small and build. Prisoners were first asked to make seemingly inconsequential statements like, "The United States is not perfect." Each small compliance led to increasingly substantial requests. Explaining these imperfections, listing them, signing the list, reading it to others, expanding it into essays, and eventually having their words used in propaganda broadcasts. This same foot-in-the-door technique proves highly effective in business. In a California experiment, researchers found that homeowners who had previously agreed to display a tiny "Be a Safe Driver" sign were 76% likely to later permit an enormous, view-blocking "Drive Carefully" billboard on their lawns, while only 17% of others consented. The small commitment had changed their self-image into public-spirited citizens who acted on their civic principles. We determine what is correct by finding out what other people think is correct, especially regarding behavior. This principle of social proof serves as a convenient decision-making shortcut, but makes us vulnerable to manipulation. Canned laughter exemplifies this vulnerability. Despite universally disliking it, audiences laugh more and rate material funnier when accompanied by artificial laughter. Television executives understand this research and employ laugh tracks extensively, particularly for poor comedy. Like the turkey responding to a cheep cheep sound regardless of its source, humans respond to the sound of laughter even when we consciously recognize it as fake. Social proof is exploited across various settings for profit. Bartenders salt tip jars with dollar bills to suggest proper tipping behavior. Church ushers use the same technique with collection baskets. Advertisers highlight products as fastest growing or largest selling because others' approval serves as sufficient evidence of quality. As sales consultant Cavett Robert notes, since 95% of people are imitators and only 5% initiators, people are persuaded more by the actions of others than by any proof we can offer. Social proof works most powerfully when we feel uncertain. When situations are ambiguous, we look to others' actions for guidance. But this creates a dangerous phenomenon called pluralistic ignorance. In emergencies, everyone searches for social evidence with brief camouflaged glances, seeing everyone else looking unruffled. By the principle of social proof, events are wrongly interpreted as non-emergencies while danger mounts. Research by Latane and Darley showed that emergency victims actually have better chances with a single bystander than a crowd. A seizure victim received help 85% of the time with one bystander versus only 31% with five present. The problem isn't callousness. When people are certain an emergency exists, they help readily. The issue is uncertainty, especially among strangers who don't want to appear unsophisticated. The Jonestown tragedy exemplifies the power of social proof in extreme conditions. After relocating his People's Temple from San Francisco to the isolated jungles of Guyana, Jim Jones created perfect conditions for compliance. Uncertainty in an alien environment where followers had no similar others except fellow cult members. When Jones called for mass suicide, the orderly procession toward death was facilitated by two powerful forms of social evidence: the initial willing participants who drank poison first, and the crowd's own misinterpreted calm as each person looked to others for cues. The principle that we prefer to say yes to people we know and like is exploited by compliance professionals in countless ways. The Tupperware party represents the quintessential American compliance setting, combining multiple influence weapons but deriving its true power from the liking rule. By having friends host parties where they profit from sales to their social circle, Tupperware brilliantly arranges for customers to buy from and for a friend rather than a stranger. Research confirms this strategy's effectiveness. The strength of the social bond between hostess and guests is twice as likely to determine purchases as product preference itself. Physical attractiveness creates an automatic click-whir response that produces a powerful halo effect. Research shows we unconsciously assign positive traits like talent, kindness, honesty, and intelligence to attractive people. The consequences are profound. Attractive political candidates receive 2.5 times more votes than unattractive ones, though 73% of voters deny being influenced by appearance. Good-looking job applicants are hired more often regardless of qualifications, and handsome defendants receive lighter sentences in court cases. We instinctively like people who are similar to us in opinions, personality traits, background, or lifestyle. Research shows we're more likely to help those who dress like us. In one study, similarly dressed requesters received dimes for phone calls twice as often as differently dressed ones. Compliance professionals exploit this by manufacturing similarities. Car salespeople are trained to look for clues in trade-ins, camping gear, golf balls, to claim shared interests. The mere information that someone likes us can powerfully trigger reciprocal liking and compliance. Joe Girard, the world's greatest car salesman, sent all 13,000-plus former customers monthly greeting cards with just three words, "I like you." This seemingly impersonal approach worked because humans are phenomenal suckers for flattery. A North Carolina experiment confirmed this vulnerability. Men liked flatterers best even when they knew the praise givers needed favors, and even when the compliments were obviously false. The association principle works powerfully in both directions. Just as we avoid being connected to bad news, we eagerly connect ourselves to positive events and people. Gregory Razrin's luncheon technique experiments in the 1930s demonstrated how people became fonder of political statements they encountered while eating. This unconscious transfer of positive feelings builds on Pavlov's classical conditioning work, where he taught dogs to salivate at bells by associating them with food. The chapter opens with a detailed examination of Stanley Milgram's groundbreaking experiment at Yale University. A volunteer arrives at a psychology lab to participate in what's described as a study of memory and learning. Through an apparently random drawing, actually rigged, one participant becomes the teacher, while another becomes the learner. The learner, who is actually a skilled actor, is strapped to a chair with electrodes in an adjacent room. The teacher must administer increasingly powerful electric shocks for wrong answers on a memory test, starting at 15 volts and increasing in 15-volt increments up to 450 volts, labeled as danger, severe shock, and XXX. The disturbing results of Milgram's experiment revealed that approximately 65% of subjects administered what they believed were dangerous 450-volt shocks to innocent victims simply because an authority figure in a lab coat instructed them to continue. These weren't inherently cruel individuals, but ordinary people from all walks of life. Teachers, plumbers, priests, housewives, who showed extreme physical distress while following orders. Many subjects exhibited severe anxiety symptoms, trembling, sweating profusely, stuttering, nervous laughter, and even having seizure-like fits. Yet they continued, often justifying their actions by saying, "I was just following orders," or "the experiment required me to continue." Our deep-seated obedience to authority serves crucial societal functions, enabling sophisticated structures for production, trade, defense, and social control that would be impossible in a state of anarchy. From earliest childhood, we're systematically taught that obedience to proper authority is right and disobedience is wrong. This lesson comes through multiple channels: parental discipline, school rules, religious instruction, and legal systems. This cultural programming creates such a powerful automatic response that we typically obey authorities without conscious deliberation in what Cialdini calls a click-whir fashion, because it's usually advantageous for survival and social harmony. The most intriguing aspect of authority influence is that we respond as readily to symbols of authority as to genuine authority itself. Con artists and manipulators exploit this psychological shortcut by adorning themselves with authority symbols, impressive titles, professional clothes, and status trappings. A fascinating example occurred in a Midwest hospital where a caller claiming to be a doctor ordered a nurse to administer a dangerous dosage of an unauthorized drug to a patient. Despite violating hospital protocols, the nurse complied until stopped by another staff member. Titles represent a particularly powerful authority symbol that simultaneously require years to earn legitimately, yet can be instantly adopted by those seeking automatic deference. In a revealing study at an Australian university, researchers demonstrated how titles affect physical perception. The same visitor was perceived as growing taller with each academic rank increase. When introduced as a student, then lecturer, senior lecturer, and finally professor, students estimated the individual grew approximately 2.5 inches taller despite no physical change. Clothing serves as another potent authority symbol, triggering automatic compliance. Social psychologist Leonard Bickman's studies demonstrated this dramatically. A requester in a security guard uniform achieved 92% compliance with unusual requests, such as directing strangers to give money to someone at a parking meter, compared to only 42% compliance when the same person wore civilian clothes. Similarly, a study in Texas showed that a jaywalker in a business suit created 3.5 times more followers than the same person in casual attire, highlighting how professional dress codes can command authority even in potentially dangerous situations. The chapter opens with G.K. Chesterton's quote, "The way to love anything is to realize that it might be lost," introducing the principle of scarcity as a powerful influence technique. The author illustrates this concept through his personal experience with the Mormon temple in Mesa, Arizona, where he suddenly became interested in visiting only when he learned that certain areas would soon be permanently closed to non-Mormons. The scarcity principle, that opportunities seem more valuable when their availability is limited, influences everyday decisions. People are more motivated by potential loss than equivalent gain, as shown in studies of homeowners more likely to insulate when told of potential losses rather than savings. The principle explains why collectors value rare or flawed items and why compliance professionals use limited number and deadline tactics to drive sales. The scarcity principle derives power from two sources. First, we use an item's limited availability as a shortcut to judge its quality, as difficult-to-obtain items are typically better than easily accessible ones. Second, and more uniquely, we resist threats to our freedom. When free choice is limited or threatened, our need to retain freedoms makes us desire them significantly more than before, a phenomenon called psychological reactance. Psychological reactance emerges around age 2, when children first recognize themselves as autonomous individuals. The Romeo and Juliet effect demonstrates how parental interference in teenage relationships actually intensifies romantic feelings rather than diminishing them. Research confirms that couples facing parental opposition report greater love and desire for marriage even while viewing their partners more critically. The scarcity principle works most powerfully under specific conditions. In Wirchel's cookie experiment, participants rated identical cookies more favorably when they came from a jar with only 2 cookies versus one with 10. But the most striking finding was that cookies that suddenly became scarce, when a jar of 10 was replaced with a jar of 2, were valued more highly than those that were scarce from the beginning. This pattern of newly experienced scarcity, creating stronger desire, applies broadly to social and political contexts. James C. Davies found that revolutions typically occur not among the perpetually deprived, but when improving conditions suddenly reverse. The most powerful form of scarcity occurs when items become unavailable due to social demand. Cookies that became scarce because others wanted them were valued more highly than those that became scarce by mistake. This explains why limited edition products and exclusive offers are so compelling. They combine scarcity with social validation. In this epilogue, Cialdini reflects on how our sophisticated human decision-making often reverts to primitive, single-feature responses in our complex modern world. Though humans possess superior cognitive abilities compared to animals, our modern information-saturated environment increasingly forces us to use mental shortcuts similar to a turkey's automatic cheep-cheep response. We simply lack the capacity to process all available information, so we rely on single cues like reciprocity, consistency, social proof, liking, authority, and scarcity to guide our decisions, especially when rushed, stressed, uncertain, or fatigued. The information explosion has created an environment where knowledge doubles rapidly in many fields, and our daily lives are characterized by novelty, transience, diversity, and acceleration. John Stuart Mill, who died in 1873, is reputed to be the last person who could know everything knowable. Today, most information is less than 15 years old, and 90% of all scientists who ever lived are working now. This technological evolution, outpacing our natural information processing capabilities, increasingly puts us in the position of lower animals, forced to rely on single-feature decision shortcuts rather than comprehensive analysis. Cialdini distinguishes between fair compliance professionals who honestly leverage these shortcuts and those who falsify or counterfeit evidence to trigger automatic responses. When facing manipulation attempts, our best defense is awareness combined with specific counter-strategies. For reciprocity manipulation, accept genuine favors while mentally redefining compliance tactics as sales devices rather than gifts. When consistency pressures feel overwhelming, consult your heart of hearts, the place where rationalizations don't penetrate, by trusting the first flash of feeling before justifications kick in. Against social proof exploitation, recognize when it's being manipulated through counterfeit evidence like staged testimonials. With authority influence, ask two key questions. Is this authority truly an expert? And how truthful can we expect the expert to be? When facing scarcity pressures, use the emotional arousal itself as a warning signal to stop and calm yourself, then assess why you truly want the item. If merely for ownership, scarcity properly influences value. But if for function, remember that scarcity doesn't improve utility. The stakes in this war with the exploiters are high, as reliable shortcuts are increasingly necessary to handle modern life's decisional burdens. We cannot allow the reliability of these vital shortcuts to be undercut without a fight. The stakes have become too high. By understanding the principles of influence, we can protect ourselves from manipulation while still benefiting from the mental shortcuts that make modern life manageable.